Welcome to the Lowdown. This is an AI-generated open-source news summary for general informational awareness. This product is not intended for use as official intelligence. The views expressed here are solely those of the cited authors and do not reflect the official policy or position of the Department of War, the United States Air Force, or any other U.S. government agency.
Here is your operational bottom line up front. Iran and North Korea are currently exploiting diplomatic ambiguities and superpower competition to secure unprecedented economic lifelines and shield themselves from sanctions. At the same time, despite receiving massive foreign aid, the Russian domestic logistical engine is physically fracturing under sustained asymmetric strikes from Ukraine. What we are tracking is how these isolated tactical adaptations are rapidly coalescing into a unified, sanction-proof economic bloc.
Right, so we've got a lot of ground to cover today. And if you're listening, we really want to untangle this massive web of global maneuvering for you.
Exactly, because it's a complicated picture.
It really is. We're looking at three major players here: Iran, North Korea, and Russia. And, you know, on a map, they might seem totally disconnected.
But the tactics they're using right now are deeply intertwined.
Exactly. And our mission today is to show you that shared playbook. We are pulling all of this from three comprehensive open-source intelligence updates from the Institute for the Study of War.
Right, the ISW.
Yeah, all dated June 16th, 2026. They cover the Middle East, the Korean Peninsula, and the Russian offensive in Ukraine. So if you really want to be well-informed about global geopolitics right now, this is the shortcut.
It really is. And I think we should just jump straight into the Middle East reporting.
Oh, absolutely. Because there is a massive development regarding the U.S.-Iran Memorandum of Understanding.
The leaked draft.
Yeah, this is huge.
It's wild. It's a 14-point draft of an MOU that's supposed to be signed in Switzerland.
Yeah.
And the core facts are, well, it outlines a 60-day negotiation period, right?
Mm-hmm.
And within the first 30 days, the U.S. is slated to lift its blockades.
Which means immediate economic relief for Iran.
Staggering relief. We are talking potentially $10 billion from just 60 days of resumed oil exports.
Right.
And then if they actually finalize a nuclear deal, there's a massive $300 billion reconstruction plan.
Which is just a colossal amount of leverage. And if you look at the ISW analysis, the key question is, so what? How does Iran actually view this?
Yeah. Do they see it as a compromise?
Not even a little bit. I mean, they are framing this entirely as a victory. You look at hardline IRGC commanders like Vahidi, for instance.
Right, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps.
Exactly. Vahidi has explicitly stated that this immediate economic relief, that $10 billion, will likely be funneled directly into their military.
Wait, directly into the military?
Yes, into the military and their proxy networks, the Axis of Resistance.
So it's basically a leaky bucket.
That's a great way to put it, yeah.
The U.S. is, you know, pouring in this massive economic relief to hopefully halt nuclear progress. But there are all these holes where the resources just pour right back into Iran's military aims. Precisely. And it's not just the money, it's the language in the text. There are some incredibly dangerous ambiguities in this MOU.
Okay, yeah, let's talk about the text, because there's a clause about territorial integrity,
right? Right, territorial integrity clause. It essentially says the U.S. won't interfere in Iran's internal affairs.
But, and this is what I want to ask you, if the Strait of Hormuz is internationally recognized as a shipping lane, how can Iran realistically exploit that clause? Like, how do they claim the strait is an internal affair?
Well, because the MOU doesn't explicitly bar them from, quote unquote, managing the strait.
Oh, well.
Yeah. So they interpret that ambiguity to mean they can continue charging these illegal transit fees. They call them service fees.
Service fees, right. So they just harass international shipping and collect a toll.
Exactly. And they do the exact same thing with the ceasefire language.
A ceasefire on all fronts.
Yeah. The MOU calls for a ceasefire on all fronts. And Iran is interpreting that as a demand for Israel to withdraw from operations against Hezbollah in Lebanon.
Wait, really? Israel isn't even part of this MOU.
I know. But they're using that broad language to basically create a diplomatic shield for their proxies.
That is just, I mean, it's a masterclass in exploiting loopholes.
It is. But Iran isn't the only one doing this. We are seeing massive economic loopholes being exploited in Asia, too.
Right. Let's pivot to the Korean Peninsula updates.
Yeah.
Because North Korea's current playbook is just as aggressive.
Oh, absolutely.
The ISW update had some crazy satellite data. The new Yalu River Bridge, which connects North Korea to China, it's seen this massive spike in construction vehicles, like going from 40 to 160 almost overnight.
And that's not even the only bridge.
Right. There's a brand new road bridge over the Tumen River connecting North Korea directly to Russia, and it's set to open on June 19th.
Which is very specific timing.
Yeah, to mark their strategic treaty anniversary. And, you know, the economic numbers back this up. Trade with China hit an 8-year high. Like $325 million in a single month.
But the trade with Russia is where it gets really interesting.
Like coal, right?
Yeah. North Korea has exported 1.5 million tons of coal.
That's a massive sanction violation. How are they doing that?
They're using false Russian flags. They forge the manifests, pretend the coal is Russian, and just bypass the sanctions entirely. And in return, North Korea has deployed roughly 14,000 troops to aid Russia's war in Ukraine.
14,000 troops. So Kim Jong-un is basically maximizing his geopolitical value here.
He really is. I mean, think about it from his perspective. By becoming this essential military supplier to Russia, he has completely diluted China's influence over Pyongyang.
It's a bidding war.
Exactly.
He's manipulated two superpowers into a bidding war for his loyalty. And that shields him from Western sanctions.
Right. Because now China is rushing to restore its leverage through these high-level diplomatic exchanges. They're letting Kim reap economic benefits from both sides.
Okay, but what about the U.S. and South Korea?
Well, the U.S., South Korea, and Japan have a trilateral response. They're scrambling to reaffirm their commitment to extended deterrence against North Korea's nuclear threats.
But, and this is a big but, South Korea has some major domestic issues right now.
Row severely.
Yeah, the reporting mentions President Lee Jae-myung's approval ratings are totally tanking.
Because of the currency exchange crisis.
Right. The won is crashing. And on top of that, there's this massive scandal with the election commission, a ballot shortage scandal.
Which completely undermines public trust.
So my question is, does this domestic weakness in South Korea make it harder for that U.S.-led coalition to actually counter Kim Jong-un's boldness?
Without a doubt. When your domestic base is dealing with a currency crisis and election scandals, you don't have the political capital to take bold, aggressive stances internationally.
You're trying to keep the lights on at home.
Exactly. So South Korea is somewhat paralyzed, which just gives Kim Jong-un more room to maneuver.
And more room to send troops to Russia, which brings us perfectly to the third update.
The Russian offensive campaign.
Right. Because all of this North Korean leverage is tied directly to the fact that Russia is desperate for those 14,000 troops.
They are incredibly desperate.
And when you look at the Russian war machine inside his own borders, it is facing some immense, unexpected logistical cracks.
That's the real story here. The asymmetrical long-range drone strikes from Ukraine.
Yeah, the strikes have been relentless. Ukraine has severely crippled Russia's domestic oil infrastructure. I mean, refining capacity has dropped by 30%.
30% in a country that is practically built on oil.
Right. It's causing massive fuel shortages inside Russia. The update mentioned that major companies, Rosneft and Tatneft, they're literally banning the sale of gasoline in canisters.
You can't even fill up a spare jug.
No. And they're limiting passenger cars to just 30 liters.
Which is nothing.
It's under 8 gallons.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, Ukrainian intelligence is revealing these shocking vulnerabilities in Russia's highest tier weaponry.
The Ashnik missile system.
Yes, the Ashnik. It's an intermediate-range ballistic missile, but apparently Russia only has one operational missile left from its original contract.
One left. And the reason why is just, it's wild.
Because they rushed the manufacturing, right? They bypassed quality assurance.
Yep. They bypassed QA to meet the Kremlin's demands, and it left the missile with a fatal flaw.
In the gyroscope.
Right. The Soviet-designed GU-503 gyroscope. Because of that flaw, these high-end missiles are missing their targets by tens of kilometers.
Tens of kilometers. That's not even close.
No, not at all. And the cascading effects of all this are huge. Because of Ukraine's strikes, Russia is being forced to establish air observation posts 50 kilometers away from the front lines.
Just to protect their basic logistics.
Just to keep their supply trucks from being blown up.
Makes me think of like a glass cannon, you know?
Mm.
Like Russia is projecting this immense outward destruction, but internally, they're relying on deeply fragile, shattering supply lines and faulty tech.
A glass cannon is the perfect analogy, because despite these massive logistical failures and rationing gas to their own citizens, the Kremlin remains entirely inflexible politically.
Which is the craziest part, because Ukrainian President Zelensky has reportedly offered to hold peace talks before the winter of 2026-2027.
He even suggested the U.S. as a neutral venue.
Right. So if Russia's actively running out of high-end missiles, relying on North Korean handouts, and literally rationing fuel, why is Putin so quick to reject Zelensky's offers?
Because for the Kremlin, accepting those negotiations would essentially be admitting defeat, or at least admitting severe vulnerability.
Right, and strong men can't show vulnerability.
Exactly. Putin continues to outright reject any negotiations that don't amount to total Ukrainian capitulation. He would rather risk internal logistical collapse than look weak.
Man. So when we pull all this together and wrap up the deep dive, it is just a stark contrast between these players.
It really is.
You've got Iran and North Korea over here, successfully leveraging geopolitical crises and this ambiguous diplomacy.
They're securing unprecedented economic lifelines.
Finding every loophole possible. But then you look at Russia, the domestic engine driving so much of this global instability. And they are physically and logistically fracturing under targeted Ukrainian pressure.
They're struggling to keep the lights on and the trucks moving.
Yeah, exactly. Which leaves me with a final kind of lingering question for everyone listening. Something to ponder after we wrap up here.
Go for it.
If these three heavily sanctioned nations, Russia, Iran, and North Korea, are increasingly sharing tactics, military hardware, and now even physical infrastructure, like that Tumen River Bridge, are we no longer dealing with just isolated rogue states? Are we actually witnessing the birth of a unified, fully integrated, sanction-proof economic bloc?
That's the million-dollar question.
Because if we are, that could render traditional Western diplomatic pressure completely obsolete.
It's a fundamental shift in the global order. And from an operational standpoint, the significance here is clear. The tactical adaptations in these three AORs are no longer regional issues. They are compounding global threats that require integrated cross-combatant command strategies to counter.
Very well said. All right, that's all for today's briefing. Thanks for joining us on The Lowdown.